This immense personal commitment is time-consuming and fraught with emotional wear and tear in giving feedback, conducting dialogues, and exposing your judgment to others. But the foundation of a great company is the way it develops people, providing the right experiences, such as learning in different jobs, learning from other people, giving candid feedback, and providing coaching, education, and training. If you spend the same amount of time and energy developing people as you do on budgeting, strategic planning, and financial monitoring, the payoff will come in sustainable, competitive advantage. What kind of people are you looking for? As we've noted earlier, in most companies, people regard a good leader as one with vision, strategy, and the ability to inspire others. They assume that if the leader can get the vision and strategy right and get his message across, the organization's people will follow. So boards of directors, CEOs, and senior executives are too often seduced by the educational and intellectual qualities of the candidates they interview. Is he conceptual and visionary? Is she articulate, a change agent, and a good communicator, especially with external constituencies such as Wall Street? They don't ask the most important question. How good is this person at getting things done? In our experience, there's very little correlation between those who talk a good game and those who get things done come hell or high water. Too often, the second kind are given short shrift. But if you want to build a company that has excellent discipline of execution, you have to select the doer.
The person who is a little less conceptual, but is absolutely determined to succeed, will usually find the right people and get them together to achieve objectives. I'm not knocking education or looking for dumb people. But if you have to choose between someone with a staggering IQ and an elite education who's gliding along, and someone with a lower IQ but who is absolutely determined to succeed, you'll always do better with the second person. I didn't always understand that. I too was of the mind that the better the education and pedigree, the smarter the person. But that's not true. You're searching for people with an enormous drive for winning. These people get their satisfaction from getting things done. The more they succeed in getting things done, the more they increase their capacity. You can easily spot the doers by observing their work habits. They're the ones who energize people, are decisive on tough issues, get things done through others, and follow through as second nature.
We see this problem particularly when highly intellectual staff people or consultants want to move into high-level line jobs. They frequently come from the best business schools, from consulting firms, and from internal jobs in finance, accounting, and strategic planning. The trouble is, they have never been tested in mobilizing line people to execute. They haven't had the experience that develops business instinct. For example, Joan was the finance director of a high-growth division of an industrial products company. She wanted to go from her staff job, in which she had no chance to become CEO, to a line position, which would make her a candidate for succession. She became leader of the largest product line in the division, with full responsibility for market share, profit and loss, and balance sheet items like receivables and inventory. It became clear within 12 months to both the company's CEO and the head of the division that she lacked important people skills to revitalize and refocus her direct reports, including replacing some people in key positions. She also did not demonstrate the courage to hold prices when customers demanded huge discounts in a recessionary economy. We're not saying that staff people can never move into line jobs. In GE, for example, Jack Welch recognized early in his tenure as CEO that he needed additional sources of leadership talent. GE recruited from the best business schools and the top consulting firms into its strategic planning and marketing consulting units. The rule was that people who were successful would move into line jobs at levels below the business unit manager. There, they were tested and had the opportunity to demonstrate whether they had the necessary people skills to become head of a unit. Jeff Immelt, the current CEO of GE, was recruited through this channel. Other prominent leaders who have moved from consulting firms or staff jobs include Louis Gerstner, chairman and until recently CEO of IBM, Jim McNerney, CEO of 3M, and Art Collins, CEO of Medtronic. Each had a chance to demonstrate his managerial skills. They energize people.
Some leaders drain energy from people and others create it. Suppose you interview someone who has great potential. He's got an elite education, good work experience, and high marks for achievement. But he's docile and reserved. He just sits there. Sometimes people like this just don't interview well, and if he's had great success, I may have to take a lot more time looking at his record before approving or disapproving him. But I'm wary about hiring him for an important leadership job. He's likely to pick people like himself, and so you'll have to ring a bell to wake them up. I want people who arrive in the morning with a smile on their faces, who are upbeat, ready to take on the tasks of the day or the month or the year. They're going to create energy and energize the people they work with, and they're going to hire people like that too.
We're not talking about inspiring people through rhetoric. Too many leaders think they can create energy by giving pep talks or painting an uplifting picture of where the business can be in a few years if everybody just does their best. The leaders whose visions come true build and sustain their people's momentum. They bring it down to earth, focusing on short-term accomplishments, the adrenaline-pumping goals that get scored on the way to winning the game. Bob Nardelli, the current chairman and CEO of the Home Depot, is an example of such an energizer. In his previous job, he headed GE Power Systems, which he transformed from a moribund business into one of the company's stellar divisions. He took over at Power Systems in 1995 after a successful stint at the Transportation Systems Division, which Jack Welch had used as a place to test executives who seemed to have potential to rise higher. Earlier, Nardelli had also run one of GE's consumer businesses. Power Systems had half of the world market for large power-generating equipment, but the business was in a major slump. Utilities had cut back sharply on capital investment, and no rebound was in sight. Nardelli had a vision for growing by enlarging the business's pond, expanding its offerings to include smaller generating equipment, moving into new industry segments, and providing not only equipment but services to its customers. At first, he ran into disbelief and resistance from a bureaucratic culture whose managers were convinced there was no way to reignite growth without resorting to price cutting. In part, Nardelli won them over and energized them with his personal style of leadership. Deeply involved in all aspects of his business, he is curious and tireless, the personification of engagement. He never finishes a conversation without summarizing the actions to be taken. He also made his vision credible by breaking it down into bite-sized successes. He got previously aloof managers to get together with the decision-makers at the utilities and other customers to learn firsthand how they could enlarge Power Systems' share of the customer's wallet. He guided them into developing new value propositions, customer by customer and account by account, and they came to see possibilities they'd never previously imagined. Managers who used to dread meetings found themselves looking forward to them because meetings at Power Systems had become forums for action and personal growth. They're decisive on tough issues. Decisiveness is the ability to make difficult decisions swiftly and well, and act on them. Organizations are filled with people who dance around decisions without ever making them. Some leaders simply do not have the emotional fortitude to confront the tough ones. When they don't, everybody in the business knows they are wavering, procrastinating, and avoiding reality. Suppose, for example, somebody comes in for an appropriation to build a new plant in a business where you're generally doing well, but the economy is going into recession. You have to ask whether this is the right time to build or whether it makes more sense to outsource. Choosing to outsource will upset good managers and make you unpopular. Your people would much rather have their own plant, and in this case, they have good long-term justification for it. But you know building at this time would be a mistake, so you have to make the tough decision. Or suppose someone you really like isn't cutting the mustard. Few tough issues are more challenging for indecisive leaders than dealing with people they've promoted who are not performing.
In January 2002, a company I work with was wrestling painfully with problems caused by indecisiveness at two different levels. As we make this recording, the outcome is still uncertain. Ralph, a 20-year veteran with the company, was promoted in January 2001 to president of the division. In the minds of the board and the CEO, this job would be Ralph's penultimate step before becoming CEO in 2003. The performance of his division was critical to the company's profits and price-earning ratio and was determined heavily by the energy and focus of its sales staff. But things were not going well. Critical sales territories were left uncovered because John, the executive vice president for sales, was slow to fill empty slots. John got the job because he was the CEO's executive assistant for 2 years. He had been identified as one of the company's high-potential people, and the CEO had promised him a key-line job. From the start, Ralph had qualms about whether John could do the job, because he felt that the man was indecisive and not an energizer. Each time Ralph talked to the CEO about his concern, he was urged to be patient and give John time to develop. With the decision about John in limbo, the division's performance was suffering and threatening the company's prospects. Competitors were gaining market share, and the industry was consolidating. If the indecisiveness continued much longer, the company would become a takeover candidate.
They get things done through others. Getting things done through others is a fundamental leadership skill. Indeed, if you can't do it, you're not leading. Yet how many leaders do you see who cannot? Some smother their people, blocking their initiative and creativity. They're the micromanagers, insecure leaders, who can't trust others to get it right because they don't know how to calibrate them and monitor their performance. They wind up making all of the key decisions about details themselves, so they don't have time to deal with the larger issues they should be focusing on, or respond to the surprises that inevitably come along. Others abandon their people. They believe wholeheartedly in delegating. Let people grow on their own, sink or swim, empower themselves. They explain the challenge, sometimes at such a high level of abstraction that it amounts to superficiality, and toss the ball entirely into their people's court. They don't set milestones, and they don't follow through. Then, when things don't get done as expected, they're frustrated. Both types reduce the capabilities of their organizations. Some people are just temperamentally unable to work well with others.
I've got a good record of hiring people, but I've made mistakes. For example, we hired a man I'll call Jim as vice president in a staff advisory role. We were all extremely impressed with him. He was smart, articulate, and extremely appealing in the way he worked with his superiors. After a year, we put him in charge of a major business unit. But a year later, the unit was in trouble. He didn't get new products launched in time, he was losing market share, and productivity was dropping. When we appraised his performance, we discovered that the people who worked for him couldn't stand him. He was abrasive, almost a drill sergeant, in words of one executive who worked with him. He didn't include others in decision-making. Over time, a wide gap grew between him and his people, to the point where he could no longer lead them. We had to remove him, and it took his successor a year to get the unit back on track. Leaders who can't work through others often end up putting in untold hours and pushing everyone else to do the same. They're like Charlie, whom I mentioned in Chapter 3. I'm always asking such people, what did you get done, and is everybody else in the game? In performance reviews, I've often had to tell some very smart 80-hour-a-week people that they need to change their work habits, and that the 80-hour-a-week is actually a major weakness. People like this usually force their direct reports to be in the office or at the plant with them on Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays. They run them ragged and drain the energy of everyone around them. I'll tell them, you must come in here less, but your performance can't change. It must be just as good as it is now. Learn how to get things done through others. Because if you can't get things done through others, ultimately, you're going to sink or burn out. If they promote others on the basis of very long hours worked, which they will because that's what impresses them, those people will have the same problem. People who can't work with others reduce the capacities of their organizations. They don't get the full benefit of their people's talents, and they waste everybody's time, including their own.
They follow through. Follow through is the cornerstone of execution, and every leader who's good at executing follows through religiously. Following through ensures that people are doing the things they committed to do according to the agreed timetable. It exposes any lack of discipline and connection between ideas and actions, and forces the specificity that is essential to synchronize the moving parts of an organization. If people can't execute the plan because of changed circumstances, follow-through ensures they deal swiftly and creatively with the new conditions. GE's senior leaders, for example, follow up every Session C after 90 days, before Session S begins, with a 45-minute teleconference among the people involved, with projects that take a long time to be completed. Leaders can either follow through one-on-one, for example, Dick Brown's after-school sessions discussed in Chapter 3, or in group settings as a feedback method. In the group, everybody learns something. The variety of viewpoints raised helps people see the criteria for the decisions, the judgments that are exercised, and the trade-offs being made. This exposure calibrates people's judgments and aligns the team. Never finish a meeting without clarifying what the follow-through will be, who will do it, when and how they will do it, what resources they will use, and how and when the next review will take place and with whom. And never launch an initiative unless you're personally committed to it and prepared to see it through until it's embedded in the DNA of an organization.
Once I embrace an initiative, I make sure it's put into effect. If I let it wane after 6 months, wasting money and people's time, that's going to reduce my effectiveness in making future initiatives. People will think, we'll give this 3 months and old Larry will be off on something else, and their body language will show that they're skeptical. So I make a point of emphasizing that I'm committed and that we're going to do this. We may do it with or without everybody's support, but we're going to do it. Then people get the message quickly that this is not an experiment.
How to get the right people in the right jobs. Traditional interviews aren't useful for spotting the qualities of leaders who execute. Too often they focus on the chronology of an individual's career development and the outline of specific assignments she's had. Interviewers don't usually dig into the person's record to see how she actually performed in her previous jobs. How, for example, did she set priorities? Did she include people in decision-making? Can she justifiably take credit for those good financial results? Or was she just moving from position to position one step ahead of calamity? There are far too many examples of people who have chalked up an admirable record by the numbers at the expense of people and then left behind a weakened organization. They jump ship at the right time, and their successors have to clean up their mess. Even when interviewers check references, they often fail to get to the heart of the matter. When you interview, you have to create a full picture of the person in your mind based on things you can learn by probing them. Then you need to find out about their past and present accomplishments, how they think, and what drives their ambitions.
Developing leaders begins with interviewing and assessing candidates. I'm not talking about overseeing the HR department and interviewing finalists. I'm talking about hands-on hiring. Most people processes are deeply flawed. Some people interview well and some don't. A person who doesn't interview well may nonetheless be the best choice for the job. That's why it's important to probe deeply, to know what to listen for, and to get supplemental data. It takes time and effort to drill down further, but it's always worth the trouble. The first thing I look for are energy and enthusiasm for execution. Does the candidate get excited about doing things, as opposed to talking about them? Has she brought that energy to everything she's done, starting with school? I don't care if she went to Princeton or Podunk State. How well did she do there? Is her life full of achievement and accomplishment? What does this person want to talk about? Does she talk about the thrill of getting things done, or does she keep wandering back to strategy or philosophy? Does she detail the obstacles that she had to overcome? Does she explain the roles played by the people assigned to her? Does she seem to have the ability to persuade and enlist others in a mission? When I'm assessing an outside candidate, I want to verify his past. It's essential to talk directly to his references. When I arrived at Allied Signal, I personally checked references for dozens of candidates. I remember fellow CEOs asking, "Why are you calling?" I'd answer that it was a personal concern of mine. If I'm going to hire someone, I don't want only human resources people checking him out. I want to check him out myself. And I don't talk to just one reference and leave the rest to HR. I try to talk with two or three, even if it takes a lot of time. You can't spend too much time on obtaining and developing the best people. Many CEOs have told me that my reference calls were different from most because I focused so much on the candidate's energy, implementation, and accomplishments. I ask, how does he set priorities? What qualities is he known for? Does he include people in decision-making? What is his work ethic and his energy level? Those types of questions get at the person's real potential. When I make a call personally, I know I'm more likely to get a candid response. If I know the reference, I'll feel confident that I'm not getting any filtering. If I can't readily get a reference from a person I know, I don't want to hire the candidate. However, if you dig a little, you can always find someone in the evaluation process with a connection to the candidate. I learned that lesson from a painful mistake I made early on in Allied Signal. I had to let a senior marketing executive go not long after I'd hired him. He was a veritable windmill who spent his time pontificating and not getting anything done. As part of my follow-up after letting him go, I checked back with his references. One of them, someone I didn't know personally, said, "Well, he's had that problem all along." The reference hadn't told me about this man's problems before because he thought he had to fear potential liability. The bottom line is that you have to be persistent in checking references and getting to the heart of the matter.
The unvarnished truth. In most companies, assessing internal candidates suffers from the same general problems as assessing external candidates. The process is typically highly structured, in some cases bureaucratic and mechanical. An executive who is preparing to evaluate a candidate gets guidance from binders prepared by staff people, which set out leadership criteria. In reviewing a person's record, you have to get to the essentials of what makes the person effective in his or her job. What was his record of accomplishments, and how difficult were they to achieve? How effective was she in galvanizing the efforts of others and stimulating them to get things done? One of the many things mechanical evaluations miss is how candidates performed in meeting their commitments, whether they did so in ways that strengthened their organizational and people capability as a whole or weakened it. How leaders meet their commitments is at least as important as whether they meet them, and is often more important. Meeting them the wrong way can do enormous damage to an organization. In a mechanical evaluation, it's simple to determine whether a candidate met his commitments. Here are the targets he was assigned to meet, and here are the numbers that show whether he did or didn't. But what other circumstances affected his ability to meet them? Did he do a superb job in the face of adversity, or put the future of his business at risk in order to succeed in the short run? In meeting them, did he also strengthen his organization, giving people assignments that developed their leadership potential and gave them room for personal growth? Or did he leave behind a burnt-out and dysfunctional team? You won't find the answers to such questions on a checklist. Meeting commitments the wrong way can sometimes have extreme consequences. Lucent and other telecommunications suppliers got into trouble when executives trying to reach ambitious revenue growth targets extended too much credit to one set of customers and agreed to take back products if the customers couldn't sell them. But here's a more typical situation. Let's say Dave and Mike made their numbers last year, but Sue missed hers. A mechanical, some would say objective, evaluation would indicate a bonus for Dave and Mike and none for Sue. But if you look more closely at the circumstances, you get a different outcome. Dave coasted to success on a stronger-than-expected market. If he'd been doing his job well, he would have beaten the projections by 20%. At Sue's unit, however, profit plunged because a raw material shortage unexpectedly increased costs by 20%. The results would have been considerably worse if Sue hadn't quickly accelerated some planned productivity improvements. Her competitors in the industry missed their targets by even more. As for Mike, he brought in the earnings he'd promised, even though his business got hit as hard as Sue's. But he did it by halting the development of two new products and forcing a lot of product into the distribution pipeline, a situation that would harm the business by causing excess inventory in the next quarter. In other words, he borrowed from the future to make his numbers today. If anybody should get a bonus, it's actually Sue. Yet time and again, people are evaluated strictly on the numbers, or on what they think are objective criteria, and are rated accordingly. When the wrong people get rewarded, the whole organization loses. Problems don't get fixed, non-performers get ahead, and the good performers start looking for jobs at places where their contributions will be recognized. In a good evaluation, the leader looks closely at how the people under review met their commitments, which people delivered consistently, which ones were resourceful, enterprising, and creative in the face of adversity, who had easy wins and didn't push for better results, and who met their commitments at the expense of the organization's morale and long-term performance. Nowhere is candid dialogue more important than in the people process. If people can't speak forthrightly in evaluating others, then the evaluation is worthless to the organization and to the person who needs the feedback. Most people we see, however, have never received an honest appraisal. It takes courage and emotional fortitude for those doing the appraisals to be forthright. More often, a manager thinks, if I sit down and tell this person she has a behavioral problem, that's a confrontational discussion, and I don't want to have that with her. Without guidance, practice, and support, moreover, many managers don't have enough confidence in their objective judgments to be critical. Don Redlinger was director of HR at Allied Signal until the merger with Honeywell, and then he returned to the same job at Honeywell in 2001. At the pre-Bossidy Allied Signal, he recalls, performance appraisals were generally delightful experiences. I would sit down with somebody who worked for me and say, gee, you know, Harry, you're just wonderful in these six things. And then evasively I'd say, just think about how you communicate with people, and wouldn't it be nice if you could even improve this wonderful capability? Everything was vague and positive, syrup, but no citrus. What the evaluator should have been thinking is, I can make this person a lot better if I tell her she's got a problem and she fixes it. If you sit down with your boss and your boss hasn't said something to you about your weaknesses, go back, because otherwise you're not going to learn anything.
I tell my leaders that they have to do the assessments in their everyday common language and in their words, not in human resource professional lingo. They can bounce ideas off the HR person. I do that myself. I'll say, here's my appraisal. You see this person. Do you have a different view? I'll consider any good ideas they have and make them part of my appraisal. But basically, it's my responsibility. The recipient needs to feel it is me, not someone else, who decides and that I care. A good candidate assessment talks about the things a candidate does well and the things he or she must do better. It's that simple. It doesn't use words that don't say anything. It's very straightforward. It's specific. It's to the point. It's useful. For example, if you are doing an assessment, you may tell the person, you're ambitious, you're enthusiastic, and you work well with people. You're conceptual, you're analytical, and you're a team player. Now, what could you do better? One, you're not aggressive enough. You're indecisive. Your standards aren't high enough. You don't develop your organization the way we ask you to. You didn't promote enough people last year. You illustrate these points with specific observations that you have made. Assessments also have to be done in the context of the person's job. At Honeywell, for example, our leaders have to constantly link people, operations, and strategy. So they look at a person's performance in each of these areas. If a man in operations is weak on strategy, say, that gets noted down as one of the things he has to work on. The leader doing the assessment has to also indicate how she may remedy the person's shortcomings if talking to him isn't enough. We're going to get this person a coach, or he needs another assignment to work on this deficiency. The leader commits herself to giving this help. Then the leader sits down with the person and discusses the appraisal. If I'm doing the appraisal myself, at the end I'll say, now I'm going to give you the last line. You've heard what I think. What would you like to add to this? He'll reply, and then I'll say, well, then, we've agreed that these are the issues you've got to work on. Now, some of the problems may be in your DNA, and you may not necessarily be able to change them. But you can modify them, improve them. Finally, the person being appraised initials the document, saying in effect, okay, you said some nice things about me, I appreciate it. I accept the fact that I have learning needs and that I will participate in seeing if I can overcome them in the days ahead. Such assessments go on and on with thousands of people throughout the whole Honeywell organization. When I go to one of the businesses, I look at the evaluations of all the top leaders there in their direct reports, maybe 50 or 75 of them. I go through all the high-potential people who were previously moved there because of their progress and performance. I identify those who aren't performing and decide what to do about them. I follow through with a 5- or 6-page memo to them individually. Then I go back 6 months later and review to see that those actions were taken. If that approach cascades down through your organization, as it's supposed to, it will change your workforce.
People who are not accustomed to giving candid appraisals will struggle with the process at first. They'll resist, says Redlinger. How do you get them to understand it? When we started, it was contentious and difficult. Sometimes you'd take an extreme position to get people's attention. Somebody would say, "Old Harry's done wonderful things." And the reaction might be, "You're crazy. He's a bum. He's never delivered results. He's full of hot air." We'd get into arguments about these people, but in the end, everyone knew more about the person being appraised. The candid appraisals taught general managers to focus on the quality of their talent as a fundamental competitive advantage. As they upgraded their organizations over time, it occurred to them that the businesses worked much better. They competed much more effectively with super talent. And the character of the conversations changed. Instead of debating the quality and performance of individuals, they became more focused on how we can help so-and-so overcome this gap in knowledge or experience or capability, or where should we move him? There's nothing sophisticated about the process of getting the right people in the right jobs. It's a matter of being systematic and consistent in interviewing and appraising people and developing them through useful feedback. The three building blocks we have described in Part 2 are the foundation for the three core processes of execution. If you have leaders with the right behavior, a culture that rewards execution, and a consistent system for getting the right people in the right jobs, the foundation is in place for operating and managing each of the core processes effectively. Part 3. The Three Core Processes of Execution. Chapter 6. The People Process. Making the Link with Strategy and Operations. The people process is more important than either the strategy or operations processes. After all, it's the people of an organization who make judgments about how markets are changing, create strategies based on those judgments, and translate the strategies into operational realities. To put it simply and starkly, if you don't get the people process right, you will never fulfill the potential of your business. A robust people process does three things. It evaluates individuals accurately and in depth. It provides a framework for identifying and developing the leadership talent at all levels and of all kinds the organization will need to execute its strategies down the road. And it fills the leadership pipeline that's the basis of a strong succession plan. Very few companies accomplish all of these objectives well. One of the biggest shortcomings of the traditional people process is that it's backward-looking, focused on evaluating the jobs people are doing today. Far more important is whether the individuals can handle the jobs of tomorrow. We have seen many people who led business units well, sometimes even superbly, who did not have the capability to take the business to the next level. Too often, companies wait until the financial results are in before making corrections in key leadership positions. By then, the damage is done. The results are lagging indicators. They record the past and with a time delay to boot.
Such people process failures cost business untold billions of dollars. Here is an unusually clear example. Some years ago, the CEO of a $4 billion chemical company invested $250 million to build a plant in Indonesia. It was part of his strategy to shift resources from a slow-growing U.S. market to developing countries. And it made good sense. He put the project in the hands of his Brazilian plant manager, who had been doing an excellent job there. Early in 2001, the CEO called me and said, "Would you go to Indonesia? I've got this investment hanging around my neck like a millstone. Have a look at it." I went to Jakarta, where I discovered that the situation was hopeless. The plant's opening was way behind schedule because of construction delays. The manager couldn't handle the contractors, get licenses, deal with the unions, or recruit the people he needed. When the plant was finally running, he wasn't able to sell what he produced. This manager did not have enough bandwidth to run a total business. That had been true in his home country of Brazil, and was even more true here in Indonesia. about which he knew little, especially how business gets done there. Yes, the man had run the Brazilian plant very well, but he was a technical professional, not a general manager. He did not understand the ins and outs of relationships with customers, markets, pricing, and the relationships you have to develop and maintain with various government authorities in a country like Indonesia. He had no ability to move in political circles, a prerequisite for doing business there. He did not see the total picture and did not have the full measure of how a business makes money, which is the heart of the skill known as business acumen. He was naive as a businessman and did not know how to pick the right local people. And there was no real contact between him and the headquarters, where nobody knew anything about Indonesia either. None of the top 20 executives had been there, even on vacation. They got their location advice from a U.S. consulting firm, which did not do anything to prepare them for the realities of doing business there. How could the company have poured $250 million into Indonesia without ensuring that its people knew how to run a business there? The CEO had picked this manager on the theory that they needed someone with a strong technical strengths, and that somebody from one developing country would be able to handle another developing country. He didn't have a people process that yielded information about the man's leadership qualities or business acumen. These kinds of decisions, putting the wrong people in place to execute a key part of a business strategy, are common. Whether they are expanding abroad or launching a new domestic plan, far too many leaders don't ask the most basic questions. Who are the people who are going to execute that strategy, and can they do it? The strategy was all right by itself, but the company had no hope of executing it. When I returned to the United States, I told the CEO that he had to write off the investment. Eventually, he gave up on Indonesia and swapped that plan for one in another country. Contrast this with people selection at another U.S.-based company with overseas businesses. The company, the third largest in its field, has done very well for its shareholders. Over the past decade, its stock has commanded a 25% premium over the S&P 500. It is no coincidence that it also captures talent information on a global database. In 1997, it faced a critical people selection issue. Its performance in Europe had been disappointing. Each country was a barony unto itself, and the company's European strategy was an unsuccessful summation of each country's strategy. The then current CEO of Europe was about to retire after failing to achieve any synergies among the baronies. Europe clearly needed a leader who could unite the businesses under a pan-European strategy and execute it with energy. The person who succeeded would be a prime candidate to run the whole company. So the criteria for the right person were rigorous. He or she would need breadth and depth, along with the ability to see external changes and link them with the business's activities, to build a new management fast and in depth, and to conceive and execute a vigorous strategy. Traditionally, the pool of people for this job came from the U.S., or to a lesser degree from Europe. There was nobody in this pool who met the criteria. But as the discussions evolved, the global database turned up an unlikely possibility. A leader in a developing country, born and raised there, had risen to head the country's operations and had succeeded over the previous 3 years beyond anybody's anticipation. In many, if not most companies, this man wouldn't even have been on the radar screen. They would have gone scouting for an outside candidate. But after thorough consideration, he was tapped for the European job. He succeeded there, too, and as of early 2002, was a strong candidate to become the company's CEO.
Identifying the match between the right person and the right job is not always as clear-cut as in the previous case. Sometimes it means replacing an excellent performer with a person who is better equipped to take the business to the next level.
For example, the manager of a key division at a major company took the business from third place to first in its industry worldwide between the late 1980s and late 1990s. He globalized it, added services to its product offerings, and increased its productivity dramatically. Few people in the company had ever been better at execution. But in a strategy session, the company's senior leadership concluded that future revenue growth would depend on an imaginative and broader redefinition of market needs and faster development of products that use new technologies to command premium pricing. Linking the strategic requirements to the dialogues of the people process, the CEO came to the conclusion that despite the manager's unparalleled accomplishments, the division couldn't reach this next level without a new leader and management team. The decision was a blow to the manager. But the company made the transition over several months, giving him time and support as he searched for a new job. He landed a great job, one that was a match for his abilities, in another company before resigning. And looking back 3 years later, the CEO's judgment was right. The new team has delivered annual growth of 15% in revenues and 18% in profits. Sometimes the problem is clear, but should have been avoided with earlier action. As we have noted before, a leader who achieves his numbers at the expense of the organization can do a great deal of damage. We know of executives who had to be removed because their negative behavior prevented their teams from working together effectively and drained energy from the entire organization. It's not hard to identify the person who is wrong for a job because of his behavior. It is better to make sure such a person doesn't rise to a critical job in the first place. Early feedback on behavior can have a major impact on your competitiveness. In many organizations, to create the discipline of execution, changes in behavior are needed at even the highest levels. Just a few years ago, I was working at a major railroad company where the behavior of the executive vice president had an incredibly negative impact on the corporation. Socially, the man, I will call him Jones, was charming. In the office, however, he was a terror, a rigid autocrat who cursed people out on an intercom that was connected to several offices in different locations over several states. Everyone knew he violated one recently reaffirmed value, respect for the individual. Because he controlled 80% of the budget and employees, his power was enormous, and he had the ability to make or break careers. It wasn't just his underlings and peers whom Jones roughed up. He was discourteous to his peers and the CEO. The CEO had left the company for a time earlier in his career and then returned before being named to the top job. Jones felt he should have gotten the job instead and therefore gave the CEO a little respect. For his part, the CEO was a bright, decent, mild-mannered person who tried gently to change Jones's behavior but got nowhere. He basically tolerated Jones because of the man's past contributions. One day I attended the railroad's executive committee meeting. The CEO, in his own nice, polite way, was explaining that the executive committee had to meet certain performance targets that required a major cost restructuring, largely in Jones's area of responsibility. Jones responded to my amazement with vulgar language and condescending behavior, telling the CEO, in no uncertain terms, that it absolutely could not be done. Jones had no fear of being fired because of the CEO's decency and mildness, and because he thought the board would not support the CEO if he moved against him. Further, Jones felt the company would be paralyzed if he were forced out. But the CEO pulled himself together and dealt with the issue by getting the board's buy-in. And in a month, Jones was out. There was a deep sigh of relief in the company. Jones' direct report then took over, and as a result of the changed behavior and cost restructuring, the stock price doubled within 4 years. Executives like Jones drain an organization of its energy and prevent people from developing. Leaders who fail to rein them in aren't doing their jobs.
A robust people process provides a powerful framework for determining the organization's talent needs over time and for planning actions that will meet those needs. It is based on the following building blocks. Linkage to the strategic plan and its near, medium, and long-term milestones, and the operating plan target, including specific financial targets. developing the leadership pipeline through continuous improvement, succession depth, and reducing retention risk. Deciding what to do about non-performers. Transforming the mission and operations of HR. Building Block 1. Linking people to strategy and operations. The first building block of the people process is its linkage to strategic milestones over the near 0 to 2 years, medium 2 to 5 years, and long terms, as well as the operating plan targets. The business leaders create this linkage by making sure they have the right kinds and numbers of people to execute the strategy. Consider XYZ Company, which produces components for airplane manufacturers. Its new strategy calls for providing not just products, but solutions, including post-sale services that will help retain customers and create annuity income. It also proposes to win non-airline customers. The dialogue in the people process zeroes in on the shift in skill mix that will be required for the new solution-selling environment. The company has many people who are very good at what they do, but to execute the new strategy, it will need to reevaluate its leadership team and acquire fresh sales talent. Whose skills will become obsolete? How much lead time will it take to train engineers for the new mission of solution designs, and who will be accountable? Determining that some of an organization's high performers can't handle the challenges of a new strategic future is a difficult social process. Who wants to tell good people they aren't capable of moving to the next level? But it has to be done. And the kind of people process we are describing forces leaders to put these questions on the table. Linking people, strategy, and operations also helps distill organizational challenges for the coming year. XYZ needs to improve supply chain management, a crucial skill when selling services to an installed base. Besides new talent, they will require elevating aftermarket to a P&L center reporting directly to the president so that it will have the focus and accountability it needs. Strategy. Become the premier global provider of XYZ systems to a multiple class of customers. Strategy milestones. Near term, 0 to 2 years. 1. Expand beyond existing product line toward selling solutions. 2. Launch new initiative to expand services to installed base. 3. Secure new expertise in technology. Medium term, 2 to 5 years. 1. Further expand penetration in existing customer segments. 2. Develop intermediate approaches to selling solutions to new customer segments. 3. Evaluate and engage alliance partners. Long term, 5+ years. 1. Become pioneers of leapfrog technology. 2. Build more useful alliances. 3. Develop low-cost sourcing ideas. Building Block 2. Developing the leadership pipeline through continuous improvement, succession depth, and reducing retention risk. Meeting medium and long-term milestones greatly depends on having a pipeline of promising and promotable leaders. You need to assess them today and decide what each leader needs to do to become ready to take on larger responsibilities. The dialogue resulting from this assessment will reveal the adequacy of the leadership pipeline in terms of quality and quantity. Nothing is more important to an organization's competitive advantage. The Leadership Assessment Summary. A useful tool in developing the total picture of the pipeline is the Leadership Assessment Summary. The summary compares both performance and behavior for a group of individuals. At XYZ, for example, The leadership assessment summary shows not only which sales executives win the big contracts, performance, but which ones collaborate with their peers and which are lone wolves.